Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy. I am joined, as usual, with my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm fighting internet problems, but other than that, I'm great. We're joined by an extra special guest again today. Travis Kimmel, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
What's the preferred title right now that you're going by?
Bearlord, right? That's the Twitter moniker. Twitter assigned me that, and I've just rolled with it.
If you want to go by Bearlord, we can jump right into it on that note, really.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So obviously, I think all three of us are very skeptical of all things cryptocurrency. But really, what I enjoy about your feed are your macro takes, because I don't understand macro markets as well as you do. And given where we're at right now with the economy, with everyone really, I guess, livid with Jerome Powell and Janet Yellen and the government in general, it might be good to hear kind of like your understanding of what's going on with the dollar, what's going on with bonds, what's, you know, with yields and all of this stuff. So let's start with your dollar takes, which you're pretty famous for. What's your current take on the U.S. dollar?
Well, I am sort of the opinion that the dollar holds this really interesting place in the financial system. You know, it's the reserve currency. And if you look back historically at what the de facto reserve currency is at any point in time, it just has a lot of impact on kind of everything. And we, you know, in the previous like big cycle, people talk about these like big, like the biggest macro cycles or these big debt cycles and, you know, all that good stuff. In the previous cycle, the reserve currency was arguably gold, because everyone sort of measured the value of currencies against gold. And there's a long tradition of gold, of course, being used as a reserve asset. And then over the course of the last, you know, 100, 150 years, there's been this slow migration away from gold as the reserve asset, which started with everybody saying, well, what we'll do is we'll just say we'll be able to exchange the dollar for gold, and then we'll measure everything against the dollar. And all was well and good in the land. And then that caused some problems, which, like, you know, historians like to dig deep on. Basically, hard currencies, you know, you go through these phases where the economy and the population will grow, and there's like kind of not enough money to go around. And sometimes that was fixed by like a gold rush. Like, you would just literally go out into the world and discover more collateral. And that was really useful. This most recent time, we basically just sort of ditched gold, and the dollar became the thing that everybody measured things against. And so if you look at how we value sovereign currencies, a lot of that is kind of their access to dollars, right? So like, this is why people store treasuries. Treasuries are these large actors arbitraging their future need for dollars. And so I like to look at the dollar as if it's this big commodity market. Like, if you think about how oil works, the reason we have oil futures is because these big producers can go arb their production. They can say, I'm going to sell December contracts right now for delivery, because I know we're going to have predictable production in December, and I want to lock in the price right now. And so they go and they basically sell December oil for delivery, and they plan to just deliver it. Like, they're not traders. They're just trying to run their P&L in a way, you know, that's really disciplined. And so these commodity markets allow producers to de-risk their delivery, and they allow people who, like a refinery who needs to buy it, to de-risk the future costs. And that's all very useful. And in the currency markets, you see big actors are effectively able to de-risk their entire GDP. So like, a sovereign can have a weird delta in their balance of trade, and they'll need dollars, or they'll have extra dollars, and they use the treasury market to do that, because the treasury market is the price of forward money. I find all this stuff super fascinating. You know, like, effectively the dollar and treasuries hold the position in the current economic system that gold used to historically. And that's kind of the basis for all of my funny little macro takes on Twitter, is this notion that the keystone to all of economics right now is the dollar. And when you see the dollar strengthening, that is an interesting thing to look at in the perspective of these stable coins, because stable coins have made this claim that they're worth a dollar. And it's actually very hard to be worth a dollar if you don't just like have a dollar, right? They haven't proven that they do. I mean, one might imagine that they would have, you know, short dated debt, which would be fine. This is a common way to do it. You have, like, you know, cash equivalents are like very short dated debt, say 3 months, right? So you're not taking a lot of risk on the duration of these things. and they're very liquid, and you can exchange them for dollars whenever you need. If people come in and have a bunch of redemptions on your stable coin and they're like, yeah, we want dollars. Short dated debt is a really effective way to do that. That's very low risk. And with treasuries are considered to have no default risk at all, right? Like governments don't default. That's just sort of the end of that government if they do. So treasuries, we assume the United States is not going to just end. They're default free. And then there is duration risk the farther out you go, because the base value of these things can change. And if you are in a situation where you're a forced seller, because people come in and they want their money back, you don't want to be a forced seller on something with long duration, because it might not be worth as much as you think it is, depending on where rates are and all that good stuff. And so I'm sort of a dollar fatalist rather than a maximalist. I just think it's this inevitable, whenever we take on a bunch of dollar denominated debt, you have to pay all that debt back at the base value plus a little bit, like whatever the interest is. And so there's this constant sort of insolvency grind that happens across all of the economy, not specific to stablecoins. But in regulated markets, there are rules about how you say you have something worth a dollar. It basically has to be backed by, you know, a level of these short-dated treasuries or cash. And I think that there is an open question as to whether the stablecoins are doing that. And so the main reason I pay so much attention to the dollar in the context of crypto specifically is that, you know, if the dollar appreciates by 5%, as it has recently, you kind of wonder, like, how are they de-risking that? Like, how are these claims that we see on the screen that Bitcoin is worth X widgets worth a dollar being backed? And so I'm continually fascinated by that aspect of crypto markets, and expect that we will see a big insolvency grind both in like the regular markets. And, you know, the yield curve is sort of hinting at that. It keeps flattening, which predates recessions. And then if it turns out these claims are not adequately backed by dollars, you would expect to see some pretty impressive fireworks.
One thing you mentioned there that struck out to me was how difficult it is to create something that reliably mimics the dollar. And this is true even for more regulated entities like money market funds. Like in 2008, the prime money market fund broke the buck and basically blew up when Lehman Brothers was unable to roll their commercial paper after all that went down. And I think it's plausible that at least the largest stablecoin probably has paper and things on its books that are meaningfully riskier than Lehman Brothers appeared before they were unable to roll their paper. And so it has always struck me as they're in a very tenuous position that can get increasingly difficult.
Yeah, I think so. And part of the way to think through that is to think of the incentives of, like, let's imagine we were to start a money market fund, right? And we're going to do it in a way that's totally non-regulated, because that's awesome. So we spin up some account in, you know, on some little island somewhere. And we're like, okay, well, we're going to issue these sort of like units of account worth a dollar, shares or whatever. I mean, with tokens, it's obviously a token. And then we're going to take in money, but our goal is to make a yield. So if we are doing that in sort of a safe regulated environment, you know, the 1 year, we get an okay yield. Let's say we had $1 billion and we're going to get like 1% off of that, because we're investing in, you know, in treasuries that are offering us 1%. That's not bad. But you can go out there and source riskier paper and get a fatter yield. And if you're in an unregulated environment, there's just sort of this constant draw to go do that, right? So you could go get commercial paper from some of these like big Chinese real estate companies that are paying significantly more, and then arbitrage the currency risk in futures or you know, the currency markets. And there's this constant incentive to do that. And so I suspect like the business model, even if we assume that this is a money market fund that is, you know, relatively good actors, unless you have regulatory pressure to do this in a super safe way, with regulators looking at it and saying, well, we don't want this to actually hurt the financial system and have you be in the position where you have to liquidate a ton of debt really quickly, because that can get weird. If you don't have that regulatory impulse, I think there is a constant capitalist incentive to get a little riskier, right? To go out, get some paper, even from other sovereigns, perhaps, who are paying higher yield because it's riskier paper. And I would suspect that there's some of that going on. I mean, of course, you know, we're working in the dark here. Like there's no actual proof either way of what's happening here. But the incentives make me suspect that there's this lure to go yield farm, particularly since that's a conversation that always happens in crypto. Like, how do we go out and farm a little more yield? And I would love to see that stuff get audited so that we could think about these stables in a way where we're like, you know, what is the actual risk you're taking on if you're holding a bunch of Tether, even for trading purposes, temporarily? And in the absence of an audit on that front, I think the best way to look at this ecosystem is as if crypto and stables and all this as a whole are almost a uniform singular entity. And the thing that will cause that to come under pressure is if there is a dollar redemption impulse that comes along for whatever reason, usually economic conditions tighten and like people need their money. Until people need to source real dollars out of this ecosystem, it's not clear to me that there's a problem. You know, there's a latent problem, but it doesn't really become an active present problem until this entire ecosystem as a whole has to go source these dollars. And until that point, you can sort of issue these as if dollars and allow people to trade back and forth, and everything's kind of fine. And I think this is the reason that people have a tendency to call it a Ponzi scheme. I don't really know that that is a strictly accurate definition. Like, if we're being really pedantic, it's probably not a Ponzi scheme, because it's a group of actors who are kind of all in it together, and there's no overriding entity like, you know, scamming everyone. It's sort of like people are creating a distributed collective belief that these tokens are worth a dollar, and investing in that idea and trading them in an as if fashion that is probably not sufficiently founded.
But so the discussion of rates actually brings up a good point, because I remember as rates were cratering out that everyone started talking about how this presented a really weird problem for stablecoins in general, because they were no longer, especially, I don't even know, did rates actually hit zero in Europe?
Yeah, they depends on, yes. It depends on where in the curve, but
so
yeah.
Like, for instance, there's Euro tethers, right? And so if all of those Euro tethers were held in like in some European bonds, ECB related stuff or whatever, the yields they would be getting would just be rock bottom. And that presented it, you had to look at it as like, okay, so they do have to go find yield somewhere. What are they going to do? But now with everyone talking again about the Fed and now hiking rates at some point is the assumption, with them, the assumption being that these stable coins did go out and find riskier assets during that period where rates were so low, is the running idea that they would just unwind those positions and then go to something less risk on as rates increase or something? I wonder what the possible problems could be with the rate hikes occurring.
This stuff ends up being, finance is hard. and it's part of why we regulate it, so that there's a good framework for actors who want to be good actors in this space. I mean, I'll take the sort of bull case on stablecoins here for a minute and say, I think it's entirely possible to run a really smart and disciplined stablecoin. Like, that seems totally possible to me. It's basically just like a money market on different rails. And I think you can make the argument that those rails might even be better. And I think what we're really missing here is a regulatory framework to ensure that that's the case. And when we think about like what is the natural effect of rates going up, well, when rates go up, you get more yield, but the base value of that paper goes down. So as rates go up, the amount that you can sell that debt for in the moment goes down. And so this is how you get this sort of like run on the bank type of thing with debt, where like, let's say you bought a bunch of paper for $1 million and you're getting 1%, and all of a sudden that paper is yielding 2%. Well, depending on the duration of it, it's going to be worth a lot less, right? Like, if you're buying 10-year paper, that's going to be worth somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% less. I mean, the math is a little more subtle than that. And so if a bunch of people come in for redemptions, you're going to need to sell more of that paper. You're going to need to sell 110% of what you bought when those redemptions come in. And at a certain point, you just run out. Like, you don't have sufficient backing to do all these redemptions. Now, if we imagine an actor in that position, the thing that you would want to do is really encourage people not to redeem so that this insolvency stays hidden. And you'll note that this, you know, the HODL behavior in crypto is this sort of mechanized cultural reinforcement that you never sell. And if you get enough people to believe that, the insolvency could remain invisible for a very, very long time. I mean, arguably forever. Like, there is a scenario in which this just never becomes a problem. I don't really believe in that, because these things have a way of working themselves out. But it's really about the fluctuation of that the base value of those bonds at a time when you would effectively be a forced seller because people are demanding their money back. And you see this even in you know, public companies or anybody who's running a treasury, really. There's a limit to how far out the risk curve they'll go, even on very safe, risk-free debt, because they don't want to be in a position where they need that money and they don't have it. And so if you're a corporation and you have, say, a five-year plan on your P&L, there's probably an argument where you ought to go ladder your bonds out, right? Like, let's say you're storing your treasury entirely in U.S. treasuries. You could theoretically project your capital needs out 5 years for all the cash that you have and then go into a bond ladder over 5 years and get a little more yield in the five-year, right? Because you're essentially making a bet, like, we won't need that cash. And I think that's probably okay if you're right. But if you get caught out and you need to redeem that, like, you're going to show a loss because you found yourself in a solvency crisis at a time when you didn't anticipate it. And so I think, you know, when we look at crypto, there's this question of how risky are these treasuries, these big pools, being with their capital allocation? Again, if we just presume that they're good actors, which is not at all given, how risky are they being with that capital allocation? And how much finesse do they have with deploying it? I mean, theoretically, to your question, yeah, they could start to go more into these safer assets that yield a little bit more as rates go up. But that presumes that they were able to time the other debt that they were holding when it was cheap, hold cash for a while, right? I mean, like, if they can do that, then sure, it's all gravy. But that's a fairly sophisticated level of finance. I mean, I know, you know, you look around Twitter and, like, a lot of people did not get the moves in rates all that correct. I mean, just people running normal, you know, basic funds, people who are really good at trading fixed income. And so you have to look at these stablecoins and you look at how they're staffed. And it's like, do we really think that they have a full complement of staff there that are experts in fixed income and trading that better than a lot of these big fixed income shops? And I think that strains the bounds of reason at a certain point.
One of the other things you mentioned that is one of the most striking things about Tether to me at this point is the incentive to go out and find higher yields. Zeke Fowkes, in his reporting for Bloomberg Businessweek, mentioned that John Betts told him that Juan Carlo De Vicini back in 2017 said he was interested in going out and finding ways to earn a bunch more on the Tether reserves. We've now seen their asset breakdowns, which give us limited but some information that suggests they've found ways to increase their yield. But one of the inexplicable things is that the advantage, if you're trying to maintain an asset to a dollar, of going after higher yield is that you can generate more dollars and keep them so that when your riskier debt starts to decrease in value, you've still got some dollars to cover that. However, the Tether, like assets over liabilities, the cushion that they should be getting from the increased yield they're generating does not ever go up. And so
yeah,
these stablecoins, or at least the stablecoin, has put itself in a position where they're exposed to this higher risk debt, but do not have the benefit of the additional dollars generated from it to protect their principal, which seems to enhance the risk of things going south.
Totally. I mean, one of the most interesting studies, you know, a lot of the stuff that's going on here is like, it's stuff that happens in other markets, right? So if you look at these peer-to-peer lending platforms, they're fascinating. I mean, a lot of them are offering peer-to-peer unsecured consumer debt. So unsecured consumer debt is nothing new. I mean, you know, it happens in, like, credit cards do this. And part of the reason that the rates on credit cards are high is that they're offering enough padding there to account for default and still make a profit. So if you have a pool of loans that default, it's like, you know, risky lending, and defaults at a 10% rate, but you can charge that pool of loans 12%, then there's profit to be made there in aggregate, right? And this is the kind of stuff that lenders think about, and it's why when rates get pushed really low, you see this become a wealth disparity accentuator. Because the lower rates are, the less room lenders have to arbitrage these big pools. And so they're like, well, we're only going to lend to the most solvent of borrowers. So the lower rates are, the more you want to focus on solvency, because you really don't have, to your point, this cushion to absorb defaults. So in a low rate world, which we're largely in, it encourages lending to hyper-solvent people who don't really need the debt as much. And if we look at what happens on these peer-to-peer platforms, you can decide who you want to lend to, and you can get really high yields. Like, you can get 12, 15%. But the reason you're getting those high yields is you're lending to really risky borrowers. And over time, even this sort of peer-to-peer lending, there's like a proper rate of return there. You build a basket, you're lending to a bunch of different people at different rates. But when you figure in the default rate and everything else, everybody ends up getting about the same amount of yield. And if you go too far out that risk curve, even with a big diversified pool, the default rate goes high enough that it's not a winning proposition. Like people just stop paying their loans down. And I think Americans live in a very equity-centric mindset, which is very much all about the upside. Equity is this funny little beast where it is a remainder that is left over after all the debts are settled. So if you have a really profitable business that doesn't have much debt, then and they're generating a lot of money, then the equity is worth a lot because you're getting a lot of excess after all this debt stuff is considered. And if you have a business that is really debt laden and the equity is going up, that's awesome, unless that business finds itself in a place where it becomes insolvent, and then that equity is worth nothing. And so equity values whip around, but they're very much a bet. Equity generally is very much a bet on the upside, right? And debt people who invest largely in fixed income, live in a world where they're obsessed with the downside, because the number one thing you want to prevent is a loan defaulting. That you're trying to get as many good loans as possible and minimize the ones that default, because if you're making 5% yield on the pool, one of those loans going to zero, I mean, it really kind of just leaves a huge hole in your book, right? So I think that the headset that people think about crypto with is very much this equity mindset, right? I mean, the thing's gone up bonkers. Like everyone is sort of thinking about the upside more than the potential downside. But if underneath all of that interesting, you know, remainder upside, there is this iceberg of solvency that's an open question. I think you could see the value of these tokens go to zero very, very quickly, because they're effectively a remainder on all of these implicit contracts, which are a promise to deliver dollars, right? Like Tether, when you're trading in Tether or you're trading in USDC or any one of these stable coins, there's an implied promise buried in there that Tether can be redeemed for a dollar. It's a debt. And everything in finance sort of rests on this notion of debt, because there are exchanges that happen that are not necessarily in real time. So like, yes, a Bitcoin is always worth a Bitcoin, but before the aggregate Bitcoin ecosystem can settle that Bitcoin value, it may need to redeem a bunch of these stable coins at some point from people who want their money out. And like, I'm not sure how much money is in that ecosystem.
Yeah, you and Doomberg both mentioned that, and I think it's interesting, but I also, I don't know, I hearken back to the beginning of our conversation about dollars, where if you look at dollars and you go back far enough, it's backed by gold, and at some point the government's like, it's not backed by gold anymore, and the dollar carries on being like essentially a great way to move value, right? And so I guess in my mind, I continue to wonder. So like the only people involved, first of all, you have like be your own bank as soon as you even enter into cryptocurrency at all. So like if you're buying Bitcoin or Ethereum or like the main cryptocurrencies, that's the whole concept, is be your own bank. And then on top of that, now we've got DeFi, which decentralized finance is attempting to be, you know, essentially lending. Like this is all lending. This is all borrowing, lending, liquidity pools, and to me, incredibly complex things that most people not only don't understand, but aren't interested in ever necessarily understanding. So you, not only do you have now complexity, but you have a very closed system where the amount of people who have any clue what's actually going on is very small. And then those people don't intend on destroying the system that has created all this wealth. So it's like what you said at the beginning about Tether. Like, I can see a picture where they just know, like, oh, yeah, they already know we're never going to get a dollar from Tether ever. But we're able to utilize Tether in such a way that doesn't even matter to them.
Yeah, that could be the case. I mean, you know, if people don't want their fiat back, I guess maybe there's no problem. But I think everyone sort of does, because that's how you buy stuff. Like, that's how you buy the Lambo. It's how you buy, you know, whatever it is you're in it for. The funny thing about crypto is the implicit promise of the number going up forever. I mean, like, what people want is basic income. That's the promise. You buy a thing. It's sort of like an annuity. You buy a thing that goes up forever, and people are essentially seeking passive income, right? It's sort of this like, it's yield farming in disguise done under the umbrella of cap gains appreciation. And I that's all well and good if it works. I think the thing that people don't recognize, there's always this discussion in the crypto sphere of like, well, what backs the dollar? And people are like, oh, well, maybe it's backed by like the military and whatever else. And at the end of the day, the thing that backs it is the rule of law. And that's why you don't see a lot of this in crypto, because like that's not part of it. Ultimately, what backs the dollar is this idea that you have, you know, money is sort of this it's a tradition. Gold was a tradition, and now the new tradition is the dollar. And it is a subset of a tradition of the rule of law. And it's why the person with the most powerful military is typically the reserve currency. It's not about bullying people. It's about, at the end of the day, if something went down, who would adjudicate that? Like, who's the biggest dog in the room who would say, no, this is actually how it goes? So if we go back, you know, and we think about like when Rome was was effectively the reserve currency. Well, they had all the roads and they had all the soldiers who controlled the roads. And if there was a dispute, eventually that bubbles up into use of force. It doesn't always get there. But like, if you're going to store your accrued wealth in a currency, you want to store it in the currency that is going to decide what has value, right? It's like the rule of law is this primary thing. It comes before money even enters the table, right? So if you're a nation state, and you're like, well, I might get into a dispute with another nation state about trade. Having a bunch of dollars in that scenario and transacting in dollars is good, because at the end of the day, like the U.S. Navy is going to blockade the loser, right? Like there's just going to be sanctions. There's always a biggest dog on the world stage. And the reason that tends to be the reserve currency is like, you kind of have to go with their decision anyway. So why would you store money in some little like off-brand currency who doesn't really have the sort of global rule of law backing that eventually comes down to kind of might makes right? I mean, like, I'm not a proponent of it. I'm more of an observer of the idea that like whoever has the biggest armies or police force or whatever it is, they kind of decide how things go. And in a benevolent regime, the way things go is communicated in advance. There is, if there's a dispute, you know, this large, powerful actor will say, hey, here's how we think this is going to resolve, because that's conducive to trade. Like, trade happens best in a stable environment. And so if we all want to prosper, then this big actor needs to basically be more or less benevolent and say, here are the rules that we're going to enforce on the global stage. And there is an incentive that comes out of that to just sort of like go with whatever they call currency. Because if it ever comes down to a ruling, that's what they're going to say. It is a known, predictable quantity. You know, this El Salvador thing is fascinating. I don't know how that's going to go. Nobody knows how that's going to go. And so how can you, as a business in El Salvador, given an option to transact between dollars and Bitcoin, say, yeah, I'm going to hold it all in Bitcoin because I'm banking that this small country is going to sort of like win out in an international dispute? I mean, it just seems nuts to me. The IMF is already flagging in the spirit of saying, of proactively saying, like, we don't think this is going to go well, that it might not go well. And so if you're holding Bitcoin as the way that you store the value you gain from your labor or whatever, there is material risk that could undergo some real price impact just from things like sanctions or a country legalizing it. And so I think that the implied value of the dollar is the fact that it is backed up by a legal and regulatory framework that is a known quantity. And you see this play out in other fields too. Like when we started our business originally, we thought we were going to be really clever. And so we incorporated it as a Colorado LLC. Because we're like, yay, Colorado. Colorado's the best, right? And that worked for a little while until we got real investors who were like, no, you're actually going to be a Delaware LLC. Because Delaware C Corps have a body of case law that is just really well known. If there were ever to be a dispute in Colorado, we just don't know how that would go. Now, it's not like they were anticipating a dispute, but they were unwilling to invest if the specter of a future dispute in a legal framework that nobody understands was part of the deal. And so we had to reincorporate as a Delaware LLC, and then it was we de-risked that potential legal challenge in an unknown environment, right? And so a lot of what you see with this reserve currency discussion is literally just like, what is the most known environment? Where do we go to be operating within a set of knowns so that we can focus on our business, which is what we're good at?
My next question is a bit of a transition away from this topic, but I'm curious how you came to Bitcoin and crypto and how your views on it have evolved over time.
Oof, it's been a long road. I mean, I think I bought my first Bitcoin, it was like 10 cents or something. So it was a long time ago. I think I initially got infatuated with the idea that I could like justify buying an expensive video card because I was mining Bitcoin. So I did that for a while. I don't even know when this was. This would have been like, I don't know, 2011, 2013, you know, and then you find out that it's this like cool little weird world and you're like looking on. I mean, I remember the Silk Road days where like everyone I knew was like buying drugs online. I'm like, this is crazy. So there was, I think early there was this sort of kind of rebellious libertarian in like the benign kind of like all drugs should be legal way, which like, you know, that's an interesting concept. I mean, a few years later, we legalized weed in Colorado and like society didn't fall apart. And it seems like it's been generally a good thing. We were paying for elementary schools with it. You just go to a store and get it. And so there was this really sort of upside narrative of like weed is harmless. We should be able to buy it. And by God, we're going to do it. And I thought that was interesting. You know, I think it's still a compelling for many people. I think there is something compelling about that, about crypto. And like, I get that. And then I think some of that stuff that I had mined and was just sitting around, at one point I saw it go to like $300, and I was a starving entrepreneur at the time. And I was like, dang, you know, we are like so poor right now. I can sell this for whatever it was. Like I didn't have that much, like $3,000 or something, and put food on the table for a month. And I'm like, this is awesome. So sold all of it and then didn't pay attention to it for a while. And then I think in the big March crash, I had sort of thought that the narrative around the halving and all that was going to pick up steam. So I actually traded Bitcoin long in 2020 because I thought it was like this interesting hype trade that was fairly benign. And then went on Twitter and, you know, started talking to people on Twitter, which is, of course, an apocalyptic hellscape. And a bunch of people started, you know, I basically, as a sort of contrarian by nature, I started kind of taking the opposite side of that. While having crypto still, just to poke around and see if I could like get a read on what the counter case is, because there's all these smart finance people saying, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to have a lot of it. And I'm like, well, screw you, I'll fight you, right? And in the course of that, and getting told to like do the research, someone pointed me at Tether, and after digging into the whole stablecoin thing, I kind of realized that a lot of my fundamental assumptions around Bitcoin were basically just false. Like it looks to me like it ended up looking to me like the Bitcoin ecosystem, which at the time was largely Bitcoin. Now there's all these new tokens and whatever, but like Bitcoin was the dominant token at the time. It looked like it had been infested with this sort of shadowy debt-like figure that was just injecting debt into the crypto ecosystem in a way that was very disingenuous. I still hold that view. I think that there is a lot of de facto debt being pushed into crypto, which is responsible for a huge part of its value. And this was the moment where I sort of turned into a crypto bear. I basically unloaded the position, realizing that I didn't understand it. It wasn't that I was like bearish, but I was deeply skeptical. I don't like having investments in things I don't understand. It's generally gone poorly. And so from that moment, I began to think of crypto as an ecosystem that was creating the thing that it was worried about. So if you know, the paranoia that crypto is trying to address is this like Weimar hyperinflation thing. And if you think about crypto as its own, as a non-territoried country, like there's sort of this country, which is crypto, and a bunch of people opt into being citizens of that country, right? Then I think that it is the Weimar Republic. Like you have a series of actors in there who are printing funny money that has not been proven to be backed and running all the numbers up. And I think what we're seeing with these crypto price explosions is a wheelbarrow full of cash needed to buy a loaf of bread, except for Bitcoin is the loaf of bread. And that's really only happening within that country. Like when the whole hyperinflation thing happened, it wasn't like Weimar hyperinflation caused hyperinflation in the US. It was very localized to the people who were transacting in that currency that was being spun up without any real ability to back it. So I think this is my view on what's happening in crypto, is that there is a sort of Weimar Republic style scenario happening where the goods traded in the crypto ecosystem, which are all these tokens, are hyperinflating inside that country in a way that will not work out well. Like just because you paid a loaf of cash or a wheelbarrow full of cash for a loaf of bread in Germany doesn't mean you can go take that loaf of bread go to the United States and get a wheelbarrow full of dollars. Like, that shit just doesn't work. So I think that at the end of all of this, what we'll see is a very similar scenario where the claimed value within the crypto ecosystem is not portable. It's not portable into an economy that has regulations and controls. I'm not entirely sure how that unwinds, but boy, am I here for it. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch.
To be fair, it's not the first time that has happened in cryptocurrency either. Like, Michael Patron just came up again recently with this whole abracadabra wonderland magic internet money thing. And Quadriga CX is super famous for Gerald Cotton having something called, I think, Quadriga Bucks. They were essentially Tether on Quadriga. But there was nothing, there's absolutely nothing backing Quadriga Bucks, and people just traded like they were dollars. It's not something that's new to crypto either, and I suspect this is why there's always certain, you know, like Bitcoin maximalists talk about, what is it, like key day or something, where you're all supposed to, like, it never had, like, they never, I don't know what the rate is, but it's not like it ever does what it's supposed to do. But the idea is that everyone's supposed to withdraw their cryptocurrency funds from the cryptocurrency exchanges on the same day.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I mean, it's a good stress test.
It's a good idea if you want to possibly not ever see your funds again because you have no idea what's going on at the cryptocurrency exchange.
Yeah, we'll just try a run on the bank. Let's try it out, see what happens. Yeah, I mean, it's a good idea if you want to. Yeah, I don't know. There's something theoretically right about it. Like many things in crypto, right? There's an element of theoretical correctness there.
Yeah.
Which I think a proper stress test there would be disastrous. But,
well, especially since historically we know many exchanges have ended up running like partial reserves on their cryptocurrencies. Quadriga, BTCE, yeah, so there's just a bunch of cryptocurrency exchanges that have done that in the past, including other ones who I'm currently forgetting. And so it makes sense why they'd want to try that. But
I think the idea of fractional reserve as well gets played with a lot. Like, there's this funny pattern matching thing that happens where the crypto ecosystem will say, well, look, fractional reserve is happening over there, so the fact that it's happening over here is not a problem. And I guess, like, I entirely reject that. It is a very thin understanding of how this fractional reserve stuff works. You know, the way that it works in the banking system is there's a level that banks need to maintain in case there's a wave of redemptions, right? In case, like, in the real economy, people decide to have key day and go in and be like, I'm going to put all my cash under my mattress. And the banks take on risk when they engage in this, right? Like, the risk when you make a loan as a bank, you make people post collateral. You know, they're posting their house and they're signing a personal guarantee, and like, they are on the hook for that. And the bank needs to believe that in the event of a default, they're okay with actually receiving that set of assets. So they got to like look out in the world and say like, yeah, this house is valued fairly. Like, if you roll into a bank and you're like, and you just bought your house for, I don't know, $500,000, and you're like, I want to take a $2 million loan out against my house, they're going to be like, there's no way we're going to do that. They're effectively buying your house. Like, that's what a mortgage, the bank is buying your house from you, handing you the cash, and then allowing you to buy it back slowly. And so all this stuff is backed, like, this idea that, you know, fiat is not backed by real assets. I'm like, of course it is. It's backed by all the real assets. Like, it is, fiat is backed by nothing but hard assets. It's backed by claims on real assets. That's why we have collateral. It's why we have personal guarantees. And when you see these sort of, like, bad copies ported over the crypto ecosystem, you know, another one is this over collateralization thing. It's like, yeah, well, these loans are over collateralized. I'm like, yeah, they're over collateralized by an asset that just lost half its value in a month. I mean, it's not, I think you would have a hard time saying that a thing is over collateralized by something that volatile without limiting that to a very specific moment in time, because it could change by 5 to 10% a day.
Francis Coppola talked to us about, you know, a haircut and all of that stuff, and how a lot of these things would essentially need 100% haircut to be properly collateralized, which is nuts. I mean, yeah.
And even that's a stretch, right? Because if you get a selling cycle, there's the potential for a self-reinforcing selling cycle where, because the collateral is lowered, it forces a liquidation. Which, if that happens enough in aggregate, like, the whole thing just implodes. That's what a deflationary crisis is. It's what the Fed's always trying to prevent with their little, you know, with their interventions and stuff.
That the specific thing you're describing was actually one of the things I discussed when MakerDAO first came out, because back when DAI was only collateralized by Ether, if it got sufficiently large enough, it was at risk of that. Yeah, and so that their own liquidations, selling off their collateral, would further liquidate people further down, and you just get into that cycle. Yeah, and Cass, to your point, the Bank of International Settlements recommended haircut for crypto is 100%. They don't recommend banks allow anyone to collateralize a loan with crypto because of what we're talking about here. It's volatile and the likelihood of a margin call is pretty high.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the types of things that are, you know, in the banking system, there is a whole set of how much you can lend against things. Like the regulations there are very complex. Like, you get different haircuts for different assets, right? And this is how the whole thing hangs together today, is that we have a set of norms that that basically say, yeah, if somebody brings in a gold bar, like, you can, if you're lending against gold, like, you know, it's pretty good. If you're lending against treasuries, it's great. And I think that the failure in the crypto ecosystem to respect the evolved complexity there is really kind of at the core of, like, what's wrong in crypto. Is it's a, you know, it's a bunch of upstarts who want to reinvent a banking system out of whole cloth. And I'm not entirely sure that can be done. I mean, I think of it like Esperanto, you know, languages don't just get, you know, just sit down with a piece of paper and like invent a language, because there's nobody knows how to talk to one another that way. Like it's an evolved trope. It's like an evolved incremental human trope, like government. And money is one of those. I'm fascinated to see how all this stuff plays out. You know, I certainly don't wish anyone in crypto ill. Like I hope everyone prospers and, you know, everything's great and all that, and, you know, take small bets, whatever. Gambling is fine. Like, I'm not against gambling. It seems like a fun gambling ecosystem. But you know, then I see people on Twitter who, like, they are like, you take a mortgage out on your house and you put it all in crypto and they're up 100% and it's like they got a free house. I feel like that's a very tenuous situation.
I feel like maybe you should pay off the mortgage at that point and let the rest ride.
Totally.
And that's, it reminds me of someone taking out a bunch of corporate debt to buy Bitcoin for their company, you know? And it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder if the thought process was just fully conceived, actually.
You know, the freest you can be is when you don't have any debts. If you live in a house that is paid off, it's hard to become a forced seller. So even if your goal is to ride, if you think crypto is going up and it's going to go through these big troughs and, like, you know, spikes, and it's going to be a really great ride, like, having a house paid off so that you don't become a forced seller of this asset that you really like when it goes through these really volatile times, it's a great idea. It's a great way to be bullish on things, is to be, like, defensive in a way where you never become a forced seller. I mean, when you think about my story there with Bitcoin, I was effectively a forced seller. Like, I was a poor entrepreneur. That's why I didn't hang on to my coins, right? And then, like, continue forgetting about them. I found this asset in the time when having that money then was more important to me. And I think that this is another interesting thing about crypto, is you have, like, that dynamic is not really priced in. It's the same reason gold can go down fairly quickly, is because people just need, you can't eat gold. You got to go trade that for food to feed your family in the real economy, even if you're bullish on gold. So you can remain bullish on an asset and still find yourself in this position where, like, you got to sell some. So anyway, I think everyone should just play safe and, like, stop repeating these things about how you should be levered to the gills on debt. I mean, that's just a very poisonous idea.
Yeah, I think that whole concept is going to start getting renounced very quickly if rates start to go up, because rates don't have to go up much from near zero for people to freak the hell out.
Yeah, we're already seeing it. To my mind, the front-end rates are almost the most interesting, because that's the stuff that's used on a day-to-day basis by business. Like, when you're running a business, you can do things like factoring your invoices. So if you have $1 million in receivables, you can go get $1 million worth of debt pretty easily. But if front-end rates go up, it's all short-term debt. So if front-end rates go up, it's more expensive to do that. And you pay a little bit more, so there's less appetite for it. It impacts profitability. I think we're starting to see some of that, and especially in earnings that are coming out now, like, you're seeing some hits to profitability across the board.
The last thing I want to ask about, this is it, I promise, is just a lot of talk about inflation right now. you're a dollar, I don't know if you want to call yourself a dollar bull, but you like the dollar. I think all of us here enjoy using the dollar. So I don't take issue with it in that regard at all. What are your expectations in regard to inflation in this next year or two?
So, well, first of all, let's bucket this into two categories. One is supply chain and sort of like the economy being in a tough spot with regard to just general mobility of people moving stuff. And that causes some inflation. Like there's less stuff on the shelves, so people charge more. And then the other side is monetary inflation. And I think that, you know, this is the one that's least understood. I think that the thing to know about monetary inflation is that money is really about duration. Like money, there's not just a quantity of money. There's a quantity of money now and forward through time. And what we've been doing somewhat with this QE stuff is pulling the duration of money forward. So imagine you take a CD out, a CD that pays like 1%, and that's locked up for 5 years. And then all of a sudden, the economy gets in a tough spot, and the bank comes to you and says, hey, we're going to allow you to liquidate this CD now with no penalty. Typically, there's a penalty. Well, it's not like there's more aggregate value there. There's just more liquid now money. This money that was locked up, sort of saved for the future and paying you a little bit, is now all available in your checking account immediately. And it's flowing around really fast and it's like hot money. I do think we're seeing a little bit of monetary inflation from that, where it's like there was a bunch of money, future money that was pulled forward into now and it's like sloshing around a lot more. It is not an aggregate increase in the raw amount of money. And the incentive structure there is changing. As rates go up, it gives people an incentive to go store some of that money. So you now have like 1 and 2 year rates that are paying like, you know, relative to recent history, decent amounts. So there's an incentive to go buy these treasuries and lock that money up. And I think that those incentives are what kind of rebalance the inflationary impulse. So typically what you see after a supply shock like we're having is you see a pretty nasty deflationary hit. And I still think we're going to go through that. And it's going to suck because everyone's off sides. Like everyone is betting on inflation. You know, it's been a good bet. And I think the natural consequence of that is that it incentivizes a lot of production. It incentivizes people to get all these supply chains back online. And when they come back online, we're going to find that people have already bought a lot of the things they wanted, Pelotons and all these things that are not recurring purchases. And that's going to hit earnings and it's going to hit consumer spending. And that results in recessions, obviously. So I think we are teeing up a kind of a double dip recession here. That's still my read.
Sweet. Well, that's a scary note to end on, but let's go ahead and run with it.
Scary note from the Bear Lord.
There you go. Well, it was wonderful having you on. Thank you for joining us. You were the first one to have me on a podcast, so
awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
You can let people know where to find you if you want them to find you.
Yes. My Twitter is Colorado Travis. I mean, look, I'll take all comers on Twitter.
If you enjoyed our interview with Travis, go ahead and give a listen to some of our other episodes. We recently interviewed Doomberg. We've been talking about DAOs. We've been talking about Michael Patron. If you're already a listener and you've been listening for a while, please give us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe. So thank you, and talk to you soon.